The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing. Not because they are easy, but because they are hard.
Start. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston. Broadcasting for 7 continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good evening, listeners. Welcome to a very special Wednesday night edition of the Space Show. I'm your host, David Livingston. Thank you for tuning in. We appreciate your being here. A couple of announcements for the week coming up. There is a Friday Space Show program, as usual, and due to Labor Day, there is no program on Sunday. And then we will resume again on Tuesday with our regular programming. And you'll see all of that on the menu and the newsletter that get published on the regular time this weekend. Tonight, our toll-free number, for those of you who would like to give us a call, it's 1-866-687-7223. And remember, we are a talk show, so that means we like to talk more than we like to receive emails. So if you can, give us a call if you have questions or comments for our guest. But if you do insist on using email, that's fine. And it is drspace, D-R-S-P-A-C-E, at thespaceshow.com. You can also post a comment on our blog, which is on our website, thespaceshow.com. All the way over to the far right is the upcoming show menu. And this program is the first one listed, so open that page, which is also our blog and archive page. All the way down at the bottom, you can post comments. You do not have to be logged into the Discuss program to use it. You can do so as a guest. And as soon as I get your comment or question, I can integrate it into our program tonight. One more quick note. We're using the 60-minute format tonight. So please do pay attention to the time. If you do have a question or an email for our guest, you want to make sure you do it while we're still broadcasting and still on air. So tonight is one of those nights during the year, maybe 3 or 4 or 5 of them a year, where we go off the space topic for very interesting other topics, because there's a lot of interesting things that go on. It's not always 100% space. So tonight we're talking about a filmmaker and potential documentary to be made about the DeLorean car. And so the guest is Jordan Livingston, and to be full disclosure here, Jordan is my oldest son. So he is a product of the San Francisco Bay Area. He graduated from Chapman University Film School, and that's in Southern California in Orange. He got his BFA in film and television production, and he wrote, directed, produced, and edited award-winning short films. And he now works full-time, and you can read about how he works in the film industry. It's all on his bio on our website. And he serves the Bay Area with his own production, post-production company, Digitaloid. And he continues to write, produce, direct, and edit indie projects, including shorts, documentaries, and music videos. And he has been working for years, I'll let him tell you about it, on an incredible DeLorean car documentary, which is now ready for filmmaking, production, and eventual distribution. It's being produced and planned as a Kickstarter, but it's really an unusual documentary. So I've seen the rough cut of it, and it's fascinating. And I think the DeLorean story and the people behind the DeLorean are part of the story. So we're going to talk about it for an hour on the Space Show because it is unique, it is interesting, and it's not something you're going to hear anyplace else. So without further ado, I'll bring Jordan onto the program, and he can start telling you about the film. So, Jordan, welcome to the Space Show. How are you doing?
thank you for having me. I'm doing very well.
So,
and thank you for the intro.
Why the DeLorean? I mean, if you want to do cars, there are so many cool antique classic cars out there. So why the interest in the DeLorean? I mean, this goes back years and years and years, I know, because I've been with you all those years. But tell the listeners, why the DeLorean? What's about the DeLorean that got your attention?
Well, there's really two parts to that answer. And the first part is, why do I like and why do so many people like the DeLorean car? And then the second part is, why did I make a movie about it? Why did I make a documentary about it? So the first part is, you know, like most people in throughout the world, they know the DeLorean car from the Back to the Future movies. And since it's so ubiquitous, I'm sure it needs no explanation, but just in case anybody has forgotten, the DeLorean was turned into a time machine, and it was the time machine in the Back to the Future trilogy with Michael J. Fox and Christopher Lloyd. And I think that what was so compelling about it, obviously I was a very young kid, I was very little when I saw the movie, but I think what's so compelling about it is that there are lots of science fiction out there like Star Trek and Star Wars and even Doctor Who and other things where there's time travel, and the time travel vehicle is a spaceship or a transporter beam, something completely imaginary. In Back to the Future, the time machine was a DeLorean, which is something that's completely real and grounded in our reality. And you could go to the car dealership and you could get in one and you could drive it. And so I think that that's what is so compelling for so many people, is that they saw this movie that they loved, and it was such a wonderful movie. And then there was something physical and tangible and real that they could actually take home. And so I think that that is a huge part of it. You know, when I was a really little kid, I saw the DeLorean. I thought it was the coolest car I'd ever seen. You know, I had no idea that it wasn't as good performance-wise as a Ferrari or a Lamborghini. You just don't know. You don't care because it's so beautiful and it's so extraordinary. And then the second part is, why did I want to make a movie about DeLorean? So the answer to that was started about 12 years ago. And about 12 years ago, there was a big press release. It was in all the blogs. It was in all the newspapers that they were going to start remaking the DeLorean again, and that a company based in Houston, Texas, was going to be coming out with brand new DeLorean. And so this caught my attention. It caught the whole world's attention. And the reality of the situation is it's much more nuanced than that. They had actually acquired all of the remaining parts that had already been manufactured in the early 80s, and they were basically going to be assembling new cars out of these old 80s parts. But they got a huge press push, and it caught my attention, and I wanted to make a short film that was sort of a little news piece, a little almost like an old, what would happen before a movie would start, like almost like a newsreel about the fact that DeLoreans were coming back. And so I made this little newsreel about the return of the DeLorean, and it was a 4-minute film that showed on Current TV, which unfortunately is no longer around. But what happened was that experience of making this little short film opened my eyes to something that I now call or refer to as the international DeLorean community. And what I had no idea was, just by making this short little 4-minute film, I received dozens, and it eventually turned into hundreds of emails and messages from DeLorean owners all over the world, from all over North America, South America, Europe, New Zealand, Australia, the Netherlands, basically everywhere, saying, hey, I have a DeLorean. Come film my DeLorean. You can stay at our house. Oh, yeah, my dad has one. It's in the garage. It's in the barn. Come film at our barn. Oh, my friend has 10 DeLoreans. He collects DeLoreans. Come see my friend's collection. Just an overwhelming amount of interest from people who owned DeLoreans. And I had no idea that there were even 10 of them on the road, let alone what I later would find out. There's more than 6,000 of them still on the road. And so I thought that there was a story there that had never been told. There had been stories told about John DeLorean and the company and the scandal surrounding the car, which I'm sure we'll go into. But there had never been a story about this community, about this 6,000 or more people who are driving a car for which there is no car company. And so I found it fascinating and intriguing, and I decided that there was a movie to be made. And that's when the journey started 12 years ago.
A couple of comments and questions. You said the DeLorean was real, but of course the flux capacitor was totally made up, imaginary. So that didn't get in the way of the fact that the time machine was actually something real, right?
Well, but it was realistic, because the thing is that you had things that were imaginary, like the flux capacitor and the plutonium reactor, but it looked like something that a guy could make in his garage, and it looked like something that a crazy mad scientist could actually make. So the idea that grounds it in reality is that there's this real car. Doc Brown goes out to a DeLorean dealership and buys a DeLorean, and he even justifies it because he says that the stainless steel construction facilitates the time travel, the flux dispersal, as he calls it. And so they had a rationale for it, and even though, of course, the flux capacitor is imaginary, it looked like something you could build yourself. And so as a little kid, you see this thing and you dream, and it becomes a fantasy. Like, if I have this car, then literally anything is possible. And so it becomes the basis of a fantasy, and it becomes the basis of a dream. And then, you know, I'm lucky enough that I reached a point in my life where eventually I could afford to own one. And so I've sort of become the same thing that I was thought to document. So, you know, I do have a DeLorean now, and I live the dream, as they say, along with the people in my film. And it really is a dream, because everywhere you go, whether you're filling up gas, whether you're taking it to the car wash, whether you're going to the movies, whether you're going to get groceries, everywhere you go, you get stopped and people recognize the car. And it's not like a Ferrari or a Bentley. They don't look at it and say, oh, look at that nice car. No, they look at it and they say, oh, look, it's a DeLorean. Everybody knows exactly what it is, and it brings a smile to their faces, and it makes their day. And so when you're driving this car around, you're spreading joy everywhere you go. It's unlike anything else. I mean, I've seen many, many, many cars that are more expensive, better performing, better quality, and more impressive by any measure, but they do not bring the same joy and satisfaction that the DeLorean brings. It's just a phenomenon.
What did the DeLorean cost when it was a current car?
So the retail price in 1981, when the DeLorean came out, was, I believe, about $26,000, which adjusted for inflation would be about somewhere between $65,000 to $70,000 today. So it was priced higher than the top-of-the-line Corvette, pretty competitively, reasonably competitive with a Porsche 928. So it was a high-end luxury car. It was still not ever in the range of the exotic cars like Ferrari and Lotus and Lamborghini, but it was slightly more expensive than a Corvette and about the same as a Porsche.
Now, in traveling and interviewing people, did you get to interview any of the people involved with the film, Christopher Lloyd, Michael J. Fox, any of the people?
Well, I did. I mean, so you've seen the movie. So a lot of the Back to the Future community and the DeLorean community overlaps. So there are these conventions called DCS in the States, and there's another convention in Europe called Eurofest. And a lot of the Back to the Future community will attend those conventions along with the DeLorean community. And so over the years, I've had the opportunity to meet a lot of the filmmakers behind Back to the Future, as well as some of the actors. So in the documentary, we do have interviews with Christopher Lloyd, who, of course, plays Doc Brown. We have an interview with Bob Gale, who is the writer and co-producer of the Back to the Future trilogy, a really prolific filmmaker. And then we have some of the filmmakers who actually built the DeLorean time machine. We had Kevin Pike, who is the special effects supervisor. He's in the movie. And Michael Chaffee, who was what's called the construction manager. He actually was physically responsible for building the time machine and all of the art and the, you know, the beautiful nonsense that is strewn about the DeLorean. That was Michael Chaffee. And so we've interviewed all of these people about their experience with the car. And some of the other actors from the movie are in it as well, such as Claudia Wells is in the movie. She plays Jennifer Parker, who's Marty's girlfriend, and Don Fullalove, who plays Mayor Goldie Wilson, and Harry Waters Jr., who, of course, is the singer Marvin Berry, who is becomes responsible for giving the song Johnny Be Good to his more famous brother, Chuck Berry.
Fascinating. Now, why did the DeLorean end up being made in Ireland?
Well, so the DeLorean was built in Northern Ireland, and to tell the story, you have to give a little bit of background about why they built this car in Northern Ireland. So first, the story starts with John DeLorean. John DeLorean is a person. He was a very prolific automaker. He rose through the ranks of General Motors as a skilled engineer, and he was responsible. He's considered to be the father of the American muscle car with the introduction of the Pontiac GTO. And the Pontiac GTO basically catapulted John DeLorean into rock star status in the automotive industry. And he becomes the youngest ever vice president to work at General Motors. And he's basically on track to becoming the CEO of General Motors. And he decides that he's completely fed up with corporate America, fed up with the automotive industry. He believes that the automotive industry is stifling innovation, holding back safety, holding back environmental concerns, and basically selling Americans the same car over and over again with new fins on it. He becomes completely disenfranchised with the system, leaves, and decides he's going to go make his own car with his own name on it, and decides that it's going to be the most futuristic car ever produced. It will be the safest car, the most environmentally friendly. It will have an Italian sports car design that rivals the most beautiful cars ever designed, and it will be made of space-age material, composites, and stainless steel skin, so it will never rust. And he's going to offer the customer a lifetime warranty and so on and so forth. And so with these lofty goals, these incredibly high ambitions, he sets out to make his car. And he finds that he cannot get it made in Detroit. And, of course, there's all kinds of conspiracy theories about the big automakers like GM and Ford blacklisting him, and there's not really any hard, evident, concrete evidence of that. But for whatever reason, he can't get the car made in Detroit. And so he starts going overseas, and he starts looking in at other countries, and he starts looking at Puerto Rico, and he starts looking in South America, and he's looking around. And this is in the late 70s, so this is like around 1977, 1978, 1979. And cut to Northern Ireland is in unrest and turmoil. They have staggering unemployment, and they're almost on the brink of civil war. And one of the biggest problems that is causing this violence is that there's no jobs and there's no economy. And so the British government are desperate to create jobs in Northern Ireland. And they wind up giving John DeLorean by far the best deal to come to Northern Ireland to completely train a workforce from scratch, they had no automotive industry whatsoever, and create over 2,000 jobs building his car, subsidized with taxpayer money. So that's what attracts him to Northern Ireland. He ends up going from a completely undeveloped, what they called a greenfield site, just a complete pasture, and not only building the world's most state-of-the-art automotive assembly factory ever built, but also designing, engineering, manufacturing, and shipping the car into dealers in under 18 months. And nothing like that had ever been done before, and nothing like that had ever been done since. And it was just a massive, unbelievable undertaking that changed the lives of everybody involved. And to this day, they still either talk about it as the best job they've ever had in their lives, or, unfortunately, the biggest heartbreak and the greatest tragedy of their lives. There are no lukewarm feelings about the DeLorean in Northern Ireland. It's either a profoundly joyful experience or a profoundly tragic experience for everybody that lived there. And from a historical standpoint and from an automotive standpoint, it's unlike anything. And I'll add, the closest thing like it would have to be Tesla. So, you know, not for 40 years did anyone even attempt to do something like this until Tesla did something somewhat similar here in California.
In the film, you have quite a few of the Northern Ireland workers who still, from what I could gather, have their loyalty and allegiance to John DeLorean and the DeLorean car, correct?
Well, some of them will never forgive him, and they hate him with a personal vengeance. But those people are definitely in the minority, and most of the people there still love him, and they love him for a lot of reasons. For one thing, he brought over 2,000 jobs to a place that had staggering unemployment, and he gave these people hope, he gave these people education, he gave these people careers. And even in the end, when everything fell apart and there was scandal after scandal and it all went downhill, even then, a lot of the decisions that John DeLorean made that were really bad decisions were rooted in his desire to keep these people employed and his refusal to just quit and give up and wanting to keep these people, have them preserve their jobs. And so for whatever else he may or may not have done, he was very loyal to the workers. I do think he was very passionate about them. The other thing is that when he would come to Northern Ireland to tour the plant and do inspections and whatnot, he had what would have appeared to have been almost a photographic memory. So he knew everyone's names, he knew their wives' names and their kids' names, and he would stop you on the factory floor and he would ask you, you know, how is your son doing and how did that operation go and how is the birthday party, how is the barbecue? And he just had this incredible personability where he would engage with these people on an individual basis and made them feel so important and so special and part of, you know, his project and his team. So as a result of that, they worked tirelessly, and there's a lot of blood, sweat, and tears in the DeLorean on the part of these workers. And some of them to this day will say it's the best job they ever had. Some of them to this day will say it's the most money they ever made. And to this day, they see a DeLorean drive by, and it's a point of pride and accomplishment and achievement. And so it's very different from John's reputation here in the States, where here in the States, a lot of the focus is on scandals and other misdeeds that John DeLorean did, which I'm sure you'll want to ask me about. but over there, they really focus on his good qualities.
You have an email from Jack, who says that he is in Denver, and he says, is there one particular country that is a headquarter for DeLorean interest? Is that the U.S., is that where most of the cars are, or is Northern Ireland the headquarters for that? And Thatcher was not favorable to him. What about DeLorean in the U.K. overall?
So to answer the first part of the question, most of the DeLoreans that are still on the roads are still in the U.S. The reason for that is that North America, specifically the U.S., was the only market for the DeLorean. So 100% of them were shipped to the United States and sold to the United States, which makes the international phenomenon even more incredible, because every single DeLorean that's in any other country besides America was imported into that country after the fact. And they're on every single continent. So that means that people in every continent on this globe imported DeLoreans back from the United States, including the ones that are in Northern Ireland and including the ones that are in the United Kingdom. So there's still, the majority of them are still in the U.S., but there are a fair amount of them everywhere. You know, in the U.K., I think in the U.K. they have a not the greatest opinion of John DeLorean. They, you know, DeLorean was accused of embezzlement and of misappropriation of funds. And so a lot of them, you know, will tell you, like, they'll see a DeLorean drive by and they'll say, hey, my tax dollars paid for that car. That's my car. You know, you get a lot of those kinds of snarky comments. The deal that DeLorean made with the British government was made with the Labour government before Thatcher. And so when Thatcher came to power, she clamped down on government aid to private enterprise. She had a very different view from the Labour government on the British government's role in subsidizing profit for-profit industry. Basically, she was diametrically opposed to the Labour government's view. So she was not a champion of preserving those 2,000 jobs, and she was not a champion of subsidizing DeLorean. Then when the allegations of financial impropriety came out and there seemed as though John DeLorean had potentially embezzled a bunch of money, along with Colin Chapman, who was also involved, who was engineering firm was Lotus Cars, a British company. And when DeLorean and Colin Chapman were accused of embezzlement, Margaret Thatcher essentially had no patience and no tolerance, and she was out to shut it down, just like she was out to shut down many other companies that were being subsidized. There is another car company, British Leyland, which she also shuttered in addition to DeLorean. And so she was not a fan. And I think that in Britain, if you subscribe to Margaret Thatcher's viewpoint, then you too are also not a fan. But if you take the view that the Labour government viewed, that they were stopping violence and saving lives and bolstering the economy, then you might have a more favorable view of DeLorean and of the enterprise.
So the drug scandal with John DeLorean was in the United States and not having anything to do with Thatcher and the UK government versus Ireland.
That's correct. So the drug scandal came towards the end. Basically, the DeLorean Motor Company was essentially about to go bankrupt, and John DeLorean was desperate to find the money to save the company. The reasons for the bankruptcy were many, the primary one being that the cars just weren't selling well enough. And there's a lot of reasons for that. When the cars shipped to the United States, the U.S. was experiencing one of the biggest blizzards ever recorded in world history, and the cars just simply couldn't get to the ports. And so they were massively delayed, and people who had placed orders were furious, and they were canceling their orders. They couldn't get to the dealerships in time. That's part of the reason. The other part of the reason is the car got mediocre reviews in terms of its performance, and it just wasn't selling well enough. On top of that, you have the allegations of embezzlement, and the British government are investigating, and they're canceling their loans, and they're calling in their debts. And so he's basically on the verge of bankruptcy, and he becomes desperate. He says he won't lay off any of the workers. He doesn't want a single worker to lose their job, he says. And he says he's going to fight for the company as long as he has a breath left in him. That's a direct quote. And so he's looking for money everywhere. He's trying to get money from private loan brokers. He's trying to get money from other governments. There's a chance he might go back to one of these other countries that originally considered the project. Like maybe he'll move the project to Venezuela. Maybe he'll move the project elsewhere. But the money just isn't there. And the British government is going to shut it down, and they're going to pull the plug. And so, desperate, he gets embroiled in what we later find out is an entrapment scheme on the part of the FBI and the DEA. They see a desperate man struggling to find money to save his company, and they basically offer him, hey, you want to start investing in a drug ring? And unfortunately and tragically, he goes along with it. And one of the ironies in all of this is that John DeLorean got acquitted on all charges. That's not to say that the case was thrown out or that there was a mistrial. No, he was found not guilty by judge and jury. And the reason for this is that he never went out there saying, I want to sell drugs. And he never went out there looking to do a drug deal. He never bought drugs. He never handled drugs. He was never, you know, had anything to do with it. He was offered a business deal, and he took it. And unfortunately, he knew what it was, but, you know, the FBI and the DEA had set him up. And so at that point, it was all over. He was arrested, and that was the end of the company. They closed the doors the next day, and that was it. Everyone was laid off, and the British government wanted nothing to do with John DeLorean ever again. Even though he was found not guilty, his reputation was destroyed, and he would actually never work in the automotive industry again. It basically ruined his life.
What happened to him when he got acquitted? What was the end result?
So he gets found not guilty on all charges on the basis of entrapment, and he walks away. He walks away free, but he spent the rest of his life fighting legal battles. There were myriad civil suits against him, and there were myriad suits from his business partners and his dealers, and he basically spent the rest of his life fighting these lawsuits. He lost everything. He was living so lavishly, so incredibly lavishly, that his estate, his house in Bedminster, New Jersey, is now a Donald Trump golf course. That's the scale that we're talking about. A Trump golf course, that was his house. So he lost all of these things paying off his legal bills. And, you know, he eventually retired and lived a simple life. And he never stopped designing new cars. He always had a new design, and he was always trying to find money to get a new car off the ground. He was trying to get investors to invest in new projects, but none of them ever took off. And it's really sad because I think people are complicated and people have multiple sides to their character. I don't think that he made the wisest decisions, and I don't think he always made the most ethical decisions. But I also think that he was a brilliant engineer and had brilliance in him. And I think it's too bad that he never really got to reach his full potential. I think he could have easily been an Elon Musk or, you know, even potentially a Henry Ford if he had had, if he had been allowed to continue innovating. But unfortunately, you know, you make choices in life, and sometimes they don't work out, and that's definitely the case with John. The happy ending to all of this is that his car will live on, and thanks to Back to the Future and thanks to the DeLorean community, they really are living his dream and keeping his dream alive. And he was right in so many ways, because even though the car that he ended up selling in the dealers was compromised, it wasn't his true vision, it was, for the most part, what he said it would be. They still look brand new because they will never rust. They look like they looked the day they drove off the showroom floor. They last forever. And so in that sense, his dream really is living on, and there's more than 6,000 of them on the road. And all of his customers are happy customers. Everybody that owns their DeLorean loves their DeLorean. So,
listener Cindy is in Seattle,
sure.
And she says, as I recall, he was married to supermodel actress Christina Ferrer, and that ended pretty abruptly and badly for him, too. What was the deal on that?
So he was married to Christina Ferrara. He had a couple of different wives. She was, I think, either his second or his third wife. And she stood by him through every day of the trial. She stood by his side and defended him and went on talk shows and defended him. But after the trial ended, I think, you know, it took a massive toll on their marriage, and they eventually split up. He later remarried, and he lived with Sally DeLorean, was his wife, for the rest of his life after Christina. So Christina went on to, you know, continue her career, and she still is on television, and she still is quite famous and quite successful. But John remarried and lived a much quieter, more simple life after that.
And Christina's the mother of his kids, correct?
So Christina is the mother of his daughter, and then they have an adopted son.
Let's go back to your film, because there's a couple of things in the draft that I saw that I had not known and really made me laugh. So Ford wanted to offer him money and would take it over if it could be a Ford. Tell us about that.
I think you're talking about the story that Bob Gale, the writer and producer of Back to the Future, tells about the Mustang,
right,
in Back to the Future. Well, I hate to take Bob Gale's story because he tells it best, and it really is his story. I won't do it justice. But the gist of it is that in movies, every movie, regardless of how big or small, can get what's called product placement, where brands will put products in the movie and pay the filmmakers money to put the brand in the movie. And it's a huge way that movies get financed. So Back to the Future was no different. And they had lots of different brands in the movie represented that you might remember, like Pepsi and Mattel and Texaco. And so the cars were no different. So the Ford Motor Company came to Universal Studios and said to Universal Studios, you know, we will give you guys a lot of money, maybe $75,000, maybe $100,000, if you guys get rid of this DeLorean and you make the time machine a Mustang. And Bob Gale famously replies, Doc Brown doesn't drive a blank Mustang. And so, you know, you'll hear that story in the documentary told with the expletive uncensored. And it's just one of the many crazy stories about how fate is such a huge factor in all this, because one different decision, one different filmmaker, one different studio executive could make an artistic or creative or financial decision differently that would have changed history. If the time machine was a Mustang, we probably would not be having this conversation right now.
There are a lot of DeLorean movies that have come out or come and gone, and certainly the story of John DeLorean is well known if people are awake and paying attention, and of a certain age, they probably know the story, or remember John DeLorean in his cars and his silver hair, and, I mean, you know, quite the dashing guy. What is unique about your approach? What's different about your movie, which is titled, if I'm getting it correct, Living the Dream, correct?
Yeah, so Living the Dream is a reference to the original marketing campaign when the DeLorean was sold, the brochures, and they even had a TV commercial on that they broadcast with the slogan, Live the Dream. So they would say, drive the DeLorean, live the dream. And that slogan, Live the Dream, has sort of been adopted by DeLorean owners who would say that they are currently living the dream. So that's where the title for the documentary comes from. And the reason why I titled it that is because my documentary is different from every other DeLorean documentary. Almost all of the DeLorean documentaries that have come out, and there have been some truly excellent ones, they focus on John DeLorean and the scandal and the drugs and the tragedy of it all. And that is a very compelling story, don't get me wrong. It's an incredible story. But they're missing this other story that truly moved me, and that is the story of this international DeLorean community where people from all walks of life who speak different languages, who have different education, vastly different politics, put all of their differences aside and come together because of this one car. And the generosity and the openness, it's really unprecedented. There's no other car club like it. You will never go to a Ferrari club or a Mustang club and be welcomed the way that the DeLorean community welcomes people. And I can tell you this because I've traveled all over the United States and I've traveled to many far corners of the world, and I've always been offered to stay in people's houses. They've refused to let me take a taxi. They drive me. I've had cell phones purchased for me in foreign countries that I didn't ask for so they could call me and keep in touch with me. I have had people invite me into their homes to do an interview and then insist that I stay there and not pay for a hotel and have their wives or their kids cook dinner. I mean, it's just a community like you've never experienced, and it's all based around this car, and I couldn't figure out why, and I had to understand why there was so much love and generosity and openness, you know, all surrounding this car. And so my movie focuses on that. It does tell the history of the car, and it does tell the history of Back to the Future, because those are obviously very important to the story. But where my movie is different is my movie is the only movie that focuses on the DeLorean community and what it means to be a DeLorean owner. And so I try to portray that experience. It's both funny and at times it's genuinely moving. And other times it's inspirational. So I think that the movie has a very positive, uplifting message. It's not about a tragedy. And it's not about a drug deal. It's about incredible people that believe in this dream. And they live this dream. And you have to see the movie to really understand, to really get it.
It in many ways, after seeing the movie, first of all, it's very refreshing because it's so different from paying attention to what goes on in our world today, because it really is inspirational and uplifting, and it has a real positive message and has a very positive attitude message. So it's a cutting above what most people produce, see, talk about, go to films and see, or something like that. And it's very, very special. So I will say that to listeners, that it, besides talking about the community, it's really an uplifting group of people. A couple of other things about the movie and this. You actually walk your talk, and so a couple of years ago, you bought yourself a DeLorean, correct?
That's right, yeah. As I said, you know, it was always my dream to own one of these cars. And I started making the movie way before I ever thought I would buy one. And I actually never thought I really would. It was always just sort of a fantasy, like, oh, someday if I'm rich, I'll buy one. But what ended up happening is I started meeting, you know, hundreds and hundreds of DeLorean owners, and I started getting messages from them from all over the country every time one would come up for sale. And I kind of became quasi-expert on DeLorean values and which ones are good and which ones aren't, and what's a good deal and what's not a good deal. And so over the course of many years, I was aware of dozens and dozens of DeLoreans that had come up for sale. And finally, one came up from someone I knew who I had interviewed in the movie. And it was just one of those opportunities that was too good to be true, where I knew that this opportunity would never happen again. And so I was faced with a choice, which is, okay, do I buy this DeLorean, or do I just decide I'm never going to buy a DeLorean? It's just not going to be something that I achieve. And so I thought about it, and I said, no, this is the chance. This is the opportunity that the universe has provided. And so I bought it. And, you know, every DeLorean is like having, I'll quote the movie as, one of the, characters in the movie puts it, it's like having an unruly teenager. So this thing comes into your life and it's unruly and it's disruptive, and you have to, accommodate your life to make it work. But when you do, it's just a joy and a love and a privilege to own and to drive.
There's another part in the movie that was pretty personal, at least to our family, where people loved their DeLorean so much, and it was so special for them. They were getting married in a DeLorean, and they were using Las Vegas and I guess other places around the world where you can do things like that. Comment on getting married in a DeLorean. You ought to know a lot about that.
Well, and as you know, I'm one of those crazy people. So the DeLorean is actually how I met my wife. I was in Northern Ireland filming for the documentary, interviewing some of the factory workers who built the car, who appear in the movie. And I went down for a long weekend to the Republic of Ireland, to Dublin, and spent the weekend in Dublin. And that's where I met my wife. And so when we got married, she actually had the idea. She was probably joking, but she said, we'll just go to Las Vegas and go through the drive-through in the DeLorean. And sounded like just about the best idea for a wedding I'd ever heard in my life. So we did it. And as you know, we got married in the Las Vegas drive-through chapel in the DeLorean. And so the DeLorean not only brings me happiness as an object, it also is responsible for me meeting my wife and finding that love as well. And it's a lesson to all of us to follow your dreams and follow your passions, because when you follow your passions, they lead you to these great unexpected places that you never would have known. So, you know, just by making this movie and, you know, doing what I love, I ended up meeting the woman that I love. So, and then she ended up wanting to get married in the DeLorean, which was, even better.
So I've talked about that wedding a couple of times on the space show, because when I went there, I had no clue what to expect. But I have to say, it was more fun than any wedding I've been to. And it really was cool. And yeah, you actually drive through, and this guy who can marry people in Las Vegas sticks his head out of a window like you're ordering a Big Mac in the drive through, and the gall doors are open in the DeLorean, and you do the vows, and they got people taking pictures, and you drive through, and then a couple of minutes later, here comes the next one that they booked, and they drive through in whatever vehicle they're using, and there were people driving through in motorcycles. But yeah, the DeLorean was very cool, and you actually drove it from San Francisco to Las Vegas, which was pretty amazing, which brings me to a question from Alan, who is in Houston, who says, Jordan, you're doing an excellent job talking about this movie, but where do you get a DeLorean repaired, and can you get parts, and also where can we see the movie?
So I'll answer the last part first, and then I'll go back to the first part. So the question of where you can see the movie. So right now, as we speak, there is a Kickstarter campaign trying to raise the money to finish post-production. So the movie is shot, it's edited, and it's basically finished, but there are a lot of expenses that crop up in order to properly finish a movie and make it broadcast standard. There are things you have to do with sound, and graphics and closed captioning, and then any of the stock footage and photographs and archival materials, those all have to be licensed. And so it's a very expensive process, and those things add up fast. And that's the phase where I'm at right now, where I'm faced with, okay, the movie's made and the movie's done, but I need to raise enough money to pay for these hard costs so that the movie can actually be released. So right now, there's a Kickstarter campaign happening, and there's only a few weeks remaining, but we are pre-selling copies of the movie, so you can already go ahead and pre-order the movie. And there are also a myriad of prizes and rewards available that have been donated by the DeLorean community. These things range from a DeLorean experience where you can have get a ride in a DeLorean in over 11 different towns in the U.S. and Canada, things like buying tickets to come to the premiere, other things like collect very rare collectible toy DeLoreans, Hot Wheels DeLoreans, DeLorean luggage. I can go on and on. There are just myriad rewards available to people who back and support this movie. And so we're trying to raise this money so that we can finish post-production and release it. This is also the first way that you can see the movie, is that by backing the movie, by supporting it, you will be the very first people to get an exclusive streaming code to stream and see the movie before anybody else. So if you would like to see it, I'm sure that the link to the Kickstarter will be put up on the Space Show website. You can also find it on our Facebook page, which is facebook.com/DeLorean movie. So if you go right now to facebook.com/DeLorean movie, you'll see the link to the Kickstarter. Click on the Kickstarter, order the movie. You'll be one of the first people to see it, and you'll be responsible for helping get it made, helping get it out there.
Listeners, let me interrupt.
Sure.
If you click on the banner ad, because the DeLorean is a sponsor for the Space Show, and the banner is adjacent to the website newsletter button on our homepage. So if you click on that, it takes you to the Kickstarter page. Plus, I posted on the blog a summary of the movie and the Kickstarter URL. So that information is already up on the blog page for this particular Space Show program. Where do you repair it, Jordan?
First part of the question is, how do you get parts and where do you repair it? So this is part of the magic that has helped keep the DeLorean alive and on the road against all odds. So people who love DeLoreans are really, really lucky, because when the company went out of business, they had already produced enough parts to make about 7,000 more DeLoreans. So when they closed the company in 1982, there were 7,000 DeLoreans worth of parts already produced. Now, they don't have every single part, but there's probably about 90% or more. So in, I want to say it was 1990, I can't remember if it was 1995 or 1997, one of the prolific DeLorean mechanics bought all the remaining inventory of the parts, shipped it all to Humble, Texas, and inventoried it and cataloged it and organized it. And so now you can literally order almost every part from the DeLorean online. It couldn't be easier. It's like going to Amazon and just ordering a part. That has made DeLorean ownership unlike owning any other classic car in history. It's just made it so easy. They also franchise out, and they have different DeLorean service centers and repair facilities that have the original parts in stock that can work on the car and service the car. They're all over the U.S., and there's, I think, one or two in Europe and in the U.K. And aside from that, if you don't go to an official DeLorean Motor Company franchise, the car itself is relatively simple to work on. The engine was made by Peugeot, Renault, and Volvo. It's what's called a PRV6. So Peugeot, Renault, and Volvo all manufactured the same engine. The parts are widely available. In the U.S., it was a Volvo engine. It's a Renault transmission. And a lot of the parts are still available because they were mass-produced and widely available. So if you have a local mechanic that can work on an 80s Volvo station wagon, they can probably muddle their way through and work on the DeLorean. It's all analog. You know, it's not a, it's, there's no computer in the car, and you don't need any special tools or special equipment. It's just good old-fashioned monkey wrench, you know, mechanics. And so because of that, the DeLoreans are relatively easy to repair and maintain. Now, having said that, things, major components on the car, like the engine, the drivetrain, things like that, are pretty reliable and pretty robust. There are some very obscure, strange oddities on the car, like the electrical system, for example, that are much more troublesome. And you will need an expert who knows what they're doing to fix certain things, certain aspects of the car. But in terms of keeping the car running, doing oil changes, doing brake jobs, shocks, coolant, the usual things that you do on any car, pretty much anyone can do them on a DeLorean. So, and anyone can order the parts. So I think this is part of what makes the DeLorean legacy so special and so unique, is these cars didn't just waste away. They were maintained, and they're still on the road. And it's just one of the unique aspects of the story.
You have another interesting email. This is from our listener, Todd, who is in San Diego. And he says, Jordan, this is a space show, so you may not know some of the things I'm going to tell you, but you mentioned stainless steel many, many times over. You also referenced Elon Musk. So you may not know that the spaceship, Starship, that Elon Musk is building, the huge rocket to go to Mars, is likely going to be fabricated out of stainless steel. There are aerospace engineering reasons for doing that. Not rusting, like you said, was a reason for doing it for the DeLorean car, is not one of those reasons, as far as I know. But since you said that DeLorean might have been an earlier version of Elon Musk, I find it sort of interesting that he designed a car out of stainless steel, and Musk wants to design his big Mars rocket out of stainless steel. In addition, an aerospace company was contracted with DeLorean to build those crazy gull wing doors. Can you talk about that? I believe it was Grumman that built those
doors. It was, yeah, that's correct. So Grumman Aerospace designed the doors. So there had been gull wing doors in the past, most notably the 1953, or it's either 53 or 54, Mercedes SL gull wing pioneered them, as far as I know. And then, of course, a few years before the DeLorean, the Bricklin had them. But whereas the Bricklin had hydraulics, had electrical lifts that lifted the doors and held them in place, the DeLoreans were counterbalanced and counterweighted, and they have no electronics and no hydraulics. And Grumman Aerospace designed what is called a cryogenically twisted torsion bar, and that's a very, very, very high-tech, fancy spring. And what's incredible about this spring is, so when you're, if you can imagine a DeLorean, if you imagine a gull wing door and you lift the latch to open the door, if you just let go of the door, the spring is lifting it up for you completely on its own. But if the spring on its own would just cause the door to fly up really fast and sort of slam. And so then they have these gas-filled struts that actually act like a brake. So you get an initial lift from the spring, which lifts the door and starts to build momentum, and then the gas-filled struts kick in and act as a brake and slow it down to a smooth landing. And this experience, this visceral experience of opening the gullwing door, is probably what sold the car, I have to be honest. I mean, it's just an incredible experience, and the technology to make it is incredible space-age technology. But when you're using it, it's totally seamless and invisible and magical. And so that engineering, that counterbalancing, and the cryogenically twisted torsion bar, that was done by Grumman Aerospace. And, you know, that's one of the best features about the gullwing door. I'll also mention about the gullwing door, because this always comes up. You always hear from people that don't know what they're talking about. They will always say, well, gullwing doors are totally impractical. It makes no sense. If someone parks right next to you, you can't get out. You're trapped. Well, it's completely false. The gullwing doors require less clearance than a standard gullwing door, or than a standard door. And that's because there's an optical illusion that appears that the door is opening outwardly, but it's actually not opening outwardly. It's actually opening vertically. And so whereas a normal car might require almost 14 inches of clearance for a human to get out, the gullwing door only requires 7 inches of clearance, which is, in some cases, it's half. In some cases, it's less than half of a normal door. So they were very, very practical. And then John DeLorean, being, of course, an engineer first, I would be remiss if I didn't point out that because of the high sill that's required for a gullwing door, the high sill is also a safety feature that protects the passenger and the driver from a side impact. So you have space age technology, you have wow factor, and then you also have practicality and safety. And so when most people don't realize how much thought goes into it, but that is good design. I mean, that is the essence of design. You have practicality, safety, engineering, and it looks cool. And that's the thing, that the DeLorean just hit a home run. I mean, there's very few cars that can tick all those boxes. And that's what the gullwing doors was all about. It was John making a statement to the world saying, look what a great engineer I am. Look what a great designer I am. Look what a car can and should be. Car can and should be all of those things. And yeah, we'll hire space companies to make it if we have to.
We're pretty much at the end of the hour, but listeners, if you do want to get another email in real quickly at drspace@thespaceshow.com or use the phone, which is, of course, our preferred way, there's still time if you hurry up and do that. 1-866-687-7223. Jordan, what have we missed either about the story that you want your movie to tell and about the actual Kickstarter that you're working on to complete post-production and distribute the movie?
Sure. Well, again, the story that I'm trying to tell is an inspirational and moving story about individuals that devoted their lives to this dream, to the dream of this car, of a car that would be better than, you know, the minimum, better than the status quo, something that would be safe and reliable and stylish and affordable. And so there's a whole story about people who really dedicated their lives to producing that car. And then there's a story about a community that arose, and a community of people who, because of their shared passion for that car and their shared love of the DeLorean, have come together from all walks of life. And it's unprecedented. And, I find it just to be absolutely moving and inspirational. And that's the story that my movie tells, of course, along with the scandal and the history and the fact that the car was in Back to the Future. That's all there, too. But in the end, it's truly about the community. And then as far as the Kickstarter campaign, you know, I've spent 12 years making this film as an independent film. It's been my labor of love. It's been my dream to make this film. And I've been self-funding it little by little, you know, day by day for over 12 years. And it's at the point now where, in order to be released and be shared with the world, we need to raise these funds to get it up to a broadcastable standard. And, so the Kickstarter campaign is there to do that. you can pre-order your copy of the movie, and you can also get all kinds of rewards that have been donated by members of the community at all different price points across the map. And, you know, you can support this film, get an excellent reward for doing so, and also be the first to see the film by doing so. But it's not going to happen without your support. So we really, really need the support of our audience and our friends to make it happen so that this movie can get finished and get released. And so I really appreciate it if everyone would check it out. Watch the trailer, check out the trailer, and make a contribution to the campaign and pre-order the movie.
You got a last-minute email, Paul, as a listener we have in New York, and he says, how do you plan to distribute it, given that it's not part of a big movie house? Is it sort of like self-publishing a book and the distribution is next to impossible?
Well, it's not impossible at all. So one of the things that has happened over the last 12 years since I started making the film is that distribution models have changed dramatically. And so in some ways, taking as long as I've taken to slowly make this film by myself independently has actually been really, really good for the project. So in this day and age, you can distribute the movie online. There are a variety of platforms. There's, of course, the ones you know about, like iTunes and Amazon, and there are just many platforms for online distribution. So that's going to be our first milestone, is just doing an online distribution on iTunes and Amazon and some other online streaming platforms, as well as video, as well as downloading platforms where you can download and own the copy to watch anytime you want on any device you want. That's our first sort of milestone. And if we're able to raise enough money to pay for the licensing, then the next milestone would be DVD and Blu-ray. And again, selling that through online channels like Amazon is very easy to do. But the main way that the movie is going to be released, at least at first, is going to be iTunes and Amazon, and there will be both streaming versions as well as downloadable versions. So, and that infrastructure is there, and it means that people can see the movie 24/7 all over the world.
What about theaters that take indie films and film festival kind of theaters and things like that?
Well, yeah, absolutely. We're going to be showing it in film festivals all over the world, wherever they'll take it, wherever they'll show it. Again, first we have to get the funding sorted so we can finish the sound and pay for licensing and finish post-production. But once post-production is finished, it's going to be sent out to a whole bunch of festivals. It's also going to be shown at various car festivals and various car shows. So there's going to be opportunities to see it theatrically as well.
So one more thing, and I know we're over and I'll let you go, but, there are opportunities, as I understand it, so correct me if I'm wrong, for Kickstarter participants at certain reward levels to have credits in the film. Can you explain that? Am I wrong, or did I get it right?
No, you're correct. So we realize that a lot of people might want to become an executive producer or an associate producer, you know, in a movie that includes such great people as Christopher Lloyd, and or they might just even love the movie so much that they just want to make it happen, and they want to be responsible for making this thing happen. So yes, some of the rewards that are available are executive producer, co-producer, and associate producer credits, and those are things that are available in limited quantities to Kickstarter backers, but everybody who contributes over, I believe it's anyone that contributes over $15 and up, you will get a special thanks in the credits, and your name will be in the credits. So you don't have to be extremely wealthy to have your name in the credits. It's available to a wide variety of people who want to have their name on the movie and say that they helped make this happen and that they helped get this movie made. So anyone that basically pre-orders a copy of the movie on Kickstarter gets their name in the special thanks.
And you have about 3 weeks left. Kickstarters are timed, right? So you have about 3 weeks remaining in the campaign?
From the point at which we're talking now, there's currently 22 days left, which is plenty of time. So there are 22 days to go, but don't wait. You know, the sooner you make a pledge, the better. And you have absolutely nothing to lose, because if the funds are not raised, then none of the pledges are debited. So you only spend money if the fundraiser is successful, and you basically have nothing to lose. So either the fundraiser is successful, you get your rewards and you get to see your movie, or the fundraiser is not successful and you don't spend a penny. So there's no reason to wait. Go ahead and pledge now.
Is there a contact way if people listening to this program, even on archives, have questions that they want to ask you? Can they reach you, or can they reach someone involved with the post-production?
Yeah, absolutely. The best way to reach me, again, is on the Facebook page for the movie. You can go to facebook.com/DeLorean Movie. That's DeLorean Movie. Facebook.com/DeLorean Movie. They can send me a message there. They can contact me there. They can also send me an email at DeLoreanMovie@gmail.com.
And DeLorean Movie is one word, correct?
That's right. DeLorean Movie@gmail.com.
Anything we've omitted or forgotten, or that you wanted to share with us that we, for some reason, have not talked about yet?
I don't think so. I think we've covered a lot of ground. I think we've pretty much covered it. Just I'm very grateful to you for having me on, and thank you for your time. And I'm very grateful to your listeners if they go and check out the Kickstarter and watch the trailer. And if they're able to help make this movie into a reality, I very much appreciate it.
I got one more last-minute question for
you. Sure.
Doug is in Tyler, Texas, and he says, I have an antique Edsel car, and one of the strange things that I experience when I'm driving it is cops pull me over, and I think I'm getting a ticket, but they just want to see the damn Edsel. Do you ever have that experience with a DeLorean when you're actually driving it? Do you get pulled over by police because they want to see the car?
I've never been pulled over personally, but this is something I hear about from a lot of the owners who I've interviewed, so I do think this is very common. They get pulled over all the time, and the officer says, you know, do you know why I pulled you over, sir? And they say, no, officer, why? And they say, oh, I just wanted to see your car. And I hear this all the time. They also get a lot of 88 miles per hour jokes because, of course, in Back to the Future, 88 miles per hour is the speed at which you start to travel through time. So the one thing that I have heard from police officers many times, if I've driven through any kind of a police, you know, road closure or lane closure, something I've heard many times is they will, you know, look down over their sunglasses, and they'll say, make sure you keep it under 88. So I have gotten that several times.
So have you gone faster than 88, and what happens?
Well, I'll tell you that. So the speedometer, the stock speedometer in a DeLorean only goes up to 85. And many people will be surprised to hear this because, of course, in the movie Back to the Future, you clearly see the speedometer goes to 95. And it passes 88 on its way up to 95. That was all movie magic. That was not a real DeLorean speedometer. That was made by the Universal Studios art department. The real DeLorean speedometer goes up to 85 because in 1981, when the car was being sold, there was a regulation that limited speedometers to maximum speed of 85 miles per hour. So even if you bought a Ferrari in 1981, your speedometer went up to 85, which is ridiculous. You'll also notice on the DeLorean speedometer that the number 55 is highlighted in red, which I'm told is because at the time in 1981, there was a federal maximum speed limit of 55, which I find really hard to believe now considering how many states have 75. But in any case, apparently that's what I'm told. The 55 is highlighted in red. So long story short, I don't know what happens at 88. I only know that the speedometer will easily go up to 85 and sit very comfortably at 85 while the car continues to go faster. And that's all I can say. That's all I can tell you.
Jordan, we thank you for sharing the unique story of living the dream, your DeLorean movie. Good luck with your crowdfunding project. Listeners, I'd love to hear your feedback. So when you get a chance to go to the Kickstarter site, see the trailer that he's got posted there, and you listen to this show, post your comments on the blog. I know this is off the topic of space, but it's a pretty interesting story, and I hope you have appreciated hearing it tonight. Jordan, let us know how the Kickstarter is going and when the film is actually being finished up and completed and about to be made available. And we thank you for sharing the story again. Listeners, we're back live Friday morning on The Space Show. Remember, no Sunday program because of Labor Day. Do have a great holiday period. Keep it safe. Above all, keep looking up. Maybe you'll see a DeLorean up there, too. Who knows? And do remember that we need you to come back safely. It's a holiday weekend, so watch out for yourselves as well as watch out for the other guy, okay? Thank you very much for being here. Good night from Jordan, good night from David, and good night from The Space Show.